Middle Island to Palestine. Occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the 972 podcast, where we discuss underexplored issues and stories in Israel-Palestine. I'm Ben Rafe, an editor at 972 magazine. And before we start, a reminder that what we do wouldn't be possible without you, our readers and listeners. If you'd like to support our work, you can head over to 972mag.com/members and find out how to become a member of 972. Or to make a one-off contribution, you can visit 972mag.com/donate. We really appreciate it. And you can also sign up to our newsletter, The Landline, which will drop into your inbox once a week and no more, we promise. The link to subscribe is in our show notes. Now, onto the episode. We're back after a hiatus, and for this edition of the podcast, we've got a fascinating discussion involving 972 editor Amjad Iraqi and Local Cool editor Miron Rappaport. They were interviewed by 972 editor Natasha Roth-Rowland, who's here with me. Hey, Natasha.
Hey, Ben.
This episode is all about the Green Line, or rather, its disappearance. We'll get to why we're having this discussion right now in a moment. But why don't we start by defining what exactly the Green Line is?
Sure. The Green Line is the armistice line that was drawn up in 1949 between the new state of Israel and what was then Jordan, and is now the occupied West Bank. It was part of the armistice agreement signed between Israel and the surrounding countries following the 1948 war, including Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, and it was drawn on a map of the region with a green pencil, hence the moniker. After the Six-Day War in 1967, the status of the Green Line shifted, which is why it's also sometimes referred to as the pre-1967 borders. It went from being a pretty impermeable, unofficial border between two countries to demarcating two sets of territory ruled by one government, one side of it under military occupation and the other side not.
Okay, but the salience and meaning of the Green Line have shifted considerably since then, right?
Right, and that brings us to the conversation we're about to hear. 972, for some time, has been covering the gradual erosion of the Green Line, which has been happening for an array of reasons. For one thing, the number of settlement units and the settler population have grown so much, and the settlement project itself has become so normalized, that it no longer really makes sense to talk about the occupied West Bank as a separate or somehow peripheral territory as far as Israeli society and politics are concerned. It's part of the mainstream, both materially speaking and in the Israeli consciousness.
And this crossing of the Green Line hasn't just been one-way traffic, has it?
No. Coming in the opposite direction and taking root within the Green Line have been increasing militarization, securitized surveillance policies, and a settler-like mentality to Judaizing different parts of the country. These developments were made painfully obvious in May 2021 when bands of settlers, often accompanied by Israeli security forces, terrorized Palestinian citizens of Israel. They staked out and raided Palestinian neighborhoods in so-called mixed cities, violently attacked their residents, and they did so with impunity. But May 2021 also shed light on a parallel undercutting of the Green Line by Palestinians, who during what's known as the Unity Intifada demonstrated popular resistance on both sides of the line, protesting as part of a series of interconnected struggles. And more than just rebelling against Israeli oppression, this unified front was also a rebellion against the Palestinian leaders, who had, for the young activists who led this moment, played a significant part in undermining the Palestinian national movement.
Okay, so where does that leave us?
Well, the impact and legacy of May 2021 are still being grappled with. But amid that reckoning, there's been an opportunity to reassess what the Green Line does and doesn't stand for, and how its status has changed over the 73 years of its existence. And so last month, The Nation, which is the longest-running progressive magazine in the US, ran a cover feature on the disappearance of the Green Line, featuring two essays from 972's Anjad Iraqi and Local Call's Maran Rappaport. They each bore their own assessments and personal histories to their analyses of how and why the Green Line is being erased, and I really recommend both articles, which we'll link to in the show notes. So in our conversation, we'll be hearing Amjad and Maran setting out their arguments for what's happening with the Green Line and why, as well as sharing where they think we go from here.
All right, let's get to it.
Amjad, Maran, welcome to the 972 podcast.
Thanks for having us.
So Amjad, I'll start with you. You begin your piece with a moving recollection of how the start of the occupation in 1967 personally affected your family. And then you move into a reflection that might seem almost counterintuitive about how this moment served to reunite Palestinian communities that had been driven apart with Israel's founding in 1948. You write that the irony of this seismic transformation is that in its hubris and its lust for land, Israel reunified nearly half of the Palestinian people. Can you expand on that?
Certainly. So I literally opened up the essay in the only way that I thought I could, which was to relate to my grandfather. My grandfather was a teacher and historian, and he was born in Mandate, Palestine in 1929. And he went to a British Mandate school, and he experienced the Nakba. Experienced the military rule over Palestinian citizens up till 1966 and all the decades after until he passed away a few years ago. So he really kind of lived through all these multiple transformations over the years. And what kind of struck me when I was growing up, he would always share a lot of these kind of incredible stories all the way from the Mandate till today. But one thing that he kind of kept mentioning was the extent to which after military rule was lifted, that he would actually go to travel to the West Bank and Gaza. Now, just to be very clear, you know, in those first two decades after the Nakba, you basically saw the Palestinian people completely severed from each other. And there was nothing inevitable about them ever reconnecting. So you had Palestinians inside the state, you know, be folded into the Israeli state. You had Gaza basically absorbed by Egypt and the West Bank by Jordan. And any other turn of history, that would have been the case for decades. Again, there's nothing certain about the people reunifying. And this is the irony that I mentioned in the Nation piece, whereby in 1967, you saw this victory by the Israeli state and was done through this desire for this greater Israel. It was done through this idea of even its kind of securing its borders along the Jordan River and making itself more secure, but really driven also by this heavy Zionist ideology of accomplishing this dream. And you see this from Israeli officials, even those who weren't so regarded as like religious or demagogic, but who also bought into this narrative. And for my grandfather, you know, someone who was on the ground, this actually opened up a whole new path for him. He was able to see relatives who were in the West Bank, who were once upon a time on this other side of this no man's land. He was able to go back to towns like Tulkarm, which is where his old British school was. And in the years afterwards, he would lead groups and students and other teachers, etc., to go and explore the West Bank and learn about its different histories and also Gaza, and go to the shores there. And so this kind of, you know, basic ability to move, and this was somewhat privileged for him as a citizen of Israel, but also applied to some extent for those under occupation, because the permit regime hadn't really been fully formed into its place the way it is today. And so there was this kind of fluid movement that existed. And then suddenly, the Palestinians inside Israel are being reconnected with their brethren. You have Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, who, though are still connected in some forms to Jordan and Egypt because of that effective control, were also able to kind of reorient their nationality, reorient their social ties back to their historical homeland, which also was, you know, was basically ripped from them in the Nakba. So my grandfather was kind of really this personal window to kind of see this, what was inevitably a catastrophe in 67, and actually see how, historically speaking, it really provided and opened up this entire new door, which really set the trend for Palestinians to be able to rebuild their national fabric and to slowly reconnect and recenter that historical homeland in a much more unified way.
Well, that takes us to our next question, actually, and we're going to fast forward to much more recent history. You describe two elements of the May 2021 uprising, which was dubbed the Unity Intifada. Firstly, you cite it as a remarkable display of togetherness in the face of deep-seated and decades-long Israeli efforts to divide Palestinians. And you also portray it as a rebuttal by the younger generation of Palestinians to their leaders, as you write, flawed political ideas that had weakened and splintered their national movement. So what do you see as the catalyst for this grassroots activism transcending the Green Line? And what do you think it portends for the future of the Palestinian struggle?
The first thing, I guess, to point out is that this sort of common pulse that exists among Palestinians isn't really new. You know, even before 1967, of course, Palestinians still saw themselves as this people, whether they're refugees or inside the state or occupied by another state. Like, there was an understanding that there are Palestinians, of course, even before 48. And after 67, you know, because of the ability to reconnect physically and economically and so on and so forth like that, that really helped to kind of give much more substantive, you know, like a substantive social infrastructure to realize that Palestinian identity in an even stronger way. And this is at the same time that Palestinians in exile, led by the PLO, were leading the resistance struggle, armed struggle in places like Lebanon, and mobilizing people in the refugee camps. Now, this common pulse has sort of ebbed and flowed over the years, depending on certain circumstances. But what we did see was that because of this restoration of the social infrastructure, you were able to see kind of more common, or let's say more joint episodes of resistance. You had things like Land Day in 1976. And again, this isn't the first protest to protest against Israeli land dispossession, but there was this now ability to kind of send those ripples across across those borders. And basically, these have kind of ebbed and flowed, like I said, and it's ebbed and flowed in large part because of this policy of fragmentation by the Israeli state to try to splinter the Palestinian people through these different statuses, through these policies to essentially divide and conquer. And that fragmentation really does exist in many respects to this day, and feel it and experience it. But what was really extraordinary about the Unity Intifada of last year was that, kind of like you mentioned, there was this younger generation that was now leading this movement. And one of the kind of critical points that they were trying to make was that they were no longer buying into the Oslo paradigm, which kind of guided Palestinian political thinking about three decades before. Now, of course, you had the Second Intifada, for example, in 2000, which should also be perceived as this common uprising on both sides of the Green Line. But the fragmentation that was also internalized by some Palestinian leaders made us think that, for example, oh, the West Bank and Gaza were protesting in one form and Palestinian citizens were protesting in another. When in reality, and you know, the way we need to actually perceive it, was that it was that common pulse operating. And in the two decades since, you've seen like small protest waves, but nothing to that extent. And then last year, to actually see young people come out and say, we're not only seeing ourselves as one people, we're now more connected both by our social infrastructure, but also by our communications technologies. And we're asserting a different kind of political analysis that does not buy into the Oslo paradigm, that the question about two-state solutions or where the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, is leading us, that's not what we're following anymore. That we want to articulate a different kind of radical politics that makes us understand that no matter how Israel is treating us in different forms, and that includes Palestinian citizens who have relatively better rights and statuses and economic conditions than other Palestinians, and for them to come out to the streets and still say, we recognize how we're still second-class citizens, we recognize that this is still a system of colonialism and apartheid that's inherently making us inferior, and we oppose this in the same rhythm as we do with other people. And so to see that was quite extraordinary. And it really does kind of, it showed to an even very stark extent, like how much this belief that a lot of Zionist leaders had that the old would die and the young would forget is completely wrong. The exact opposite has happened. The old are dying, but the young are being even more assertive and have even more power and resources to resist.
So, Mehran, let's turn to you. You argue in your piece that the 1967 war both turned the Green Line into a de facto accepted border and set in motion almost immediately the process of its erasure. You describe how successive Israeli governments were, and I'm quoting, chipping away at both the idea and the reality of the Green Line. Break down that paradox for us.
Yes, I want to maybe to start with, I was 10 years old when the 67 war broke, and I remember, you know, I grew up in Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv is a city basically clean of Arabs, although there were, of course, when I grew up, there were Arab citizens in Israel, but I never saw them. And in Tel Aviv, even if they were there, you didn't see them. They were completely transparent. Now, the first time I really saw or felt that this is the Arabs in this land is after 67, when I traveled with my parents to Jerusalem and the West Bank. I think it's the first time that I tasted olive oil. It was the first time that Israelis started to eat hummus, because before then it was unknown. Now it became an Israeli dish, but before 67 it was completely unknown to Israeli Jews. It also was the first time, of course, when I visited the Wailing Wall, Jerusalem. I remember the atmosphere and the real excitement of my parents, who were completely not religious, from the fact that we can travel in these lands, Jerusalem, Jericho, Bethlehem, and all these areas. So for me, it was also breaking this line of fear as I grew up, because the Green Line was the line of fear. Beyond that, there were the enemies that were trying to annihilate us. So this is my personal experience, let's say, of this Green Line.
I want to interject with something. I mean, this might be apocryphal or you know, slightly misremembered, but there is this line that's kind of gone down in history that Abba Eban and other Israeli politicians would refer to the Green Line as the Auschwitz borders.
Yes, that was how I was raised. And I remember before the war, for 3 weeks before the war, I lived very close to the Tel Aviv municipality. And I remember asking myself whether the Egyptian aircraft, when they bombard Tel Aviv, and they will certainly aim at the municipality because this is a big building, our building will be hit also. So this is how I grew up. Now, yes, it's really a very paradoxical process that Israel did to the Green Line. Yes, it accepted, in a way, the Green Line as when Dayan, after the war, said, let's sit and we wait from the telephone call from the Arabs. The assumption was that the basis for any negotiation will be the Green Line. It was an artificial line created right in 49 armistice negotiation. So it was a completely artificial line. But yes, that was the basis. At the same time, I was really surprised to see many years afterwards, you know, the deeds of the Israeli government, the discussion in the Israeli government during the war itself, when on the second day of the war, Yigal Alon was very, he was then, I think, Minister of Labor, but he was very influential because he was the leader of the Palmach units during the 48 war. So he was very, very influential. Right on the second day, he's already talking about Israel taking over the Jordan Valley and really separating, completely disconnecting the West Bank from Jordan and really preventing an opportunity to set any Palestinian entity or, of course, to return it back to Jordan. And this process is going on all the time, almost. There is this back and forth that, yes, this is the Green Line. This is what protects the Jewish state. When the Israeli left is talking about let's make peace and return to the Green Line in order to protect Israel as a democratic and Jewish state, then the Green Line is this saving, this lifeboat that saves the Jewishness of Israel, because there in the Green Line there is this majority, this Jewish majority. At the same time, it completely wipes out the Green Line. And we've seen the latest example just a few days ago when the Tel Aviv municipality decided to print maps that includes the Green Line. And the Ministry of Education said to Tel Aviv municipality, no, you cannot do it. You cannot do it because the Green Line does not appear on Israeli official maps from 67. It was a decision by the government not to print any maps carrying the Green Line. So it's really an ongoing process of the Green Line as a defining of Israel as a Jewish state. At the same time, it's an open border for Jews to take over the whole of Palestine. So it's really a very contradictory process.
Well, we're really in sync here, because actually my follow-up question to you was going to be precisely about that Tel Aviv school textbook controversy. So, you know, you've explained it for us. There was this this issue over the Tel Aviv municipality, including the Green Line on its maps. And I just want to dig into the reasons behind that controversy a little bit more, because, you know, I mean, why does this continue to be such a sticking point for the Israeli government? I mean, the number of settlers has grown so much over the past decade that the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, is home to effectively the third largest Jewish community in the world after, you know, Israel inside the Green Line and the United States. So why the ongoing fixation with erasing a line on a map?
You know, I think Israel has, and I'm, of course, I'm not the only one saying it, Israel has a really some complex with borders, never really defined its borders. The Green Line in 49 was seen as temporary. I did a journalistic investigation a few years ago, and I was quite surprised to discover that during the 57 war, what Israel called the Sinai War in 56-57, Israel started to build settlements in Rafah. It built one settlement in Rafah and one settlement in Sharm el-Sheikh after already the UN decided that Israel should withdraw from these areas. So this expansion, hysteria almost, is built in to Israel, or maybe we go back to Zionism, of course. So this is something that's an ongoing process, and to set a line is something very, very difficult for the consensus of the Jewish community in Israel. At the same time, it backs off every time that people are talking about one political unit. there was this great chance 2 years ago after the Trump plan. There was American administration supporting basically annexing most of the West Bank and all of the settlements. There was a huge majority in Israeli parliament. There was a consensus in the Israeli parliament and a supporting American administration. And Israel at the last moment backed off and said, no, we don't want that. We don't want really a one-state reality, official one-state reality. We want an unofficial reality. Yes, this is the Israeli, problem.
Amjad, do you have any thoughts, anything to add on the Green Line map controversy?
Imran explained it very well. And that last point precisely about the official versus unofficial, I think is a very important point to take. On a lot of aspects of Israeli policy, this kind of limbo is constantly used to its advantage. And unfortunately, in international discourse, in international policy, including the US, there is this very arbitrary distinction made as if, like, even if you speak about like annexation, that de facto annexation, oh, it means it's somehow left still in the open. But the real problem is if they create a tiny piece of legislation that somehow formalizes it. And this arbitrary distinction has kind of been used almost deliberately sometimes to avoid taking any action. And Israel is more than happy to keep playing that game. And this is kind of the strategic battle that even operates within the Israeli right. Even those who agree with the concept of like formalizing annexation, for example, will only not do so in order to just keep playing that limbo game. And this is something that needs to be called out. It's like we're kind of playing the fools by sort of saying like, oh, it's okay, you guys are still doing it unofficially. But, it's 55 years of the military occupation, 100 years, we're talking about Zionism as a colonial movement, just absorbing more and more land and displacing more and more Palestinians. And somehow, because it's not written down in an official document, that's what makes it uncertain. Like, it just doesn't make sense. And as Moran explained, like, the result is very evident.
Both of your pieces propose the gradual dissolution of the Green Line as the basis for a new vision of what this land is to become, or at least a new set of terms for reckoning with the path its future will take. But given that the Green Line, for all the erasure that we're seeing, still demarcates between territory that is under military occupation and territory that is not, it continues to have real material, political, and social consequences for those Palestinians who live outside of it. How does that reality square with what you've each proposed about the Green Line's increasing irrelevance?
I would say this. First of all, this is one of the criticisms I got after the piece in The Nation, is that I overlooked the reality that the Green Line was erased for Israeli Jews, and maybe in Israelis in general, because it's also for Palestinian citizens of Israel, it's also, of course, possible to travel over the Green Line and into the West Bank. But it is very much existent for Palestinians in the West Bank and certainly in Gaza. So they carry, in a way, the Palestinian in the West Bank and Gaza, even if they cross the Green Line, and they do in hundreds of thousands of them, if you include East Jerusalemites, yet they carry it with them. It's not a physical line. It's a line between those who have rights and those who don't have rights, wherever they are. Even if they, for the moment, live in a flat in Tel Aviv as illegal workers in Tel Aviv. But they carry the line, the Green Line, on their backs. So I really maybe overlooked this, and I have to correct it. Mm-hmm. I think, as I said now, it is impossible to overlook the fact that the Green Line is still a border of occupation of those having rights and those not having rights. And for this, of course, it has to be amended immediately today that all people will have rights. Now, my point of view and I'm also part of a movement called The Land for All. In my point of view, it is still important to keep the green line in the sense that there should be two political entities, Israel and Palestine. This is the international law. This is accepted by the international law. This is accepted by most communities still as the best solution. But the green line is a physical barrier between peoples, first of all, between themselves, between the Palestinian in the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, and those in the diaspora, and the Palestinian inside Israel and Palestine, that is the places where the refugees, Palestinian refugees, were exiled from, is inside Israel, not outside Israel. It's not in the West Bank. They were deported from within what is today Israel. So it is mandatory to allow the freedom to live wherever they want in this land. And the same goes, I think, for Israeli Jews, who should be allowed to live wherever they want in this land. This requires some kind of union or confederation between these two independent states, and, of course, all kind of issues that should be handled together. But yet still not to completely erase the green line in the sense that it is a line for two independent states, for the right of self-determination for each people. I think it's still important, with all the damages that the Green Line have done.
Jeff?
I mean, on my end, there are kind of two main points I want to highlight. One is kind of a bit honing in a bit more about what the real Green Line is in Israel-Palestine. And the second is, you know, what your question raises about actually a bit of a debate and paradox that also exists within Palestinian politics and advocacy and human rights work in general. So on the first point, I mean, I agree with Maron, like, you know, there is a very practical effect that is created by the Green Line through the military regime, for the kinds of laws, statuses, et cetera, for sure. But I want to take us back to kind of to May 2021. I, for example, live in Haifa. And in Haifa, when the uprising really picked up, and especially when the war in Gaza took place, you basically saw, and this is similar with a lot of sort of quote-unquote mixed cities, you know, cities that have both Arab and Jewish populations, we basically saw these gangs, these of right-wing Jewish vigilantes, go to Arab neighborhoods and Arab homes in Haifa, which are quite known, quite clear, they're Arab neighborhoods, oftentimes with or like accompanied by police officers or with police officers looking by, and they would target those Palestinian citizens. They barged into houses, they vandalized property, they threatened, they terrorized people, chanted racist slogans, etc. At the same time that this is happening in Haifa, this, you know, it just kind of praises a city of coexistence. A few kilometers away in the West Bank, you have Jewish Israeli settlers or American Jews who now are living in settlements, essentially doing the same thing to a Palestinian village, which they've been terrorizing constantly, you know, for years now, you know, also vandalizing property, even shooting at Palestinian residents, stealing agriculture, etc. And yes, there's a difference between the two Palestinians who are there. Yes, there's a difference theoretically in this green line is operating. But what May really showed in stark terms, that the green line isn't actually this geography on the map. The green line exists between every Jewish person and every Palestinian person in the eyes of the Israeli regime. That's where the green line stands. And that's despite all these different statuses and citizenships, but that's how that line constantly operates. This is partly why you don't have a clear border, because a border is always moving with every settler, with every settlement, and with every Jewish citizen who's encroaching and pushing upon Palestinian citizens to keep them in their cage. So I think that's a very important element that needs to be kind of to challenge our thinking about how much even geographical fragmentation is really that important. And this relates to this single regime that operates, whether it's in Gaza, in the West Bank, or inside Israel. The second point is actually this internal conversation among Palestinians and these contradictions and debates, which are kind of, I think, have been floating in a lot more in recent years. They've always been around, but have been there a lot. whereby the Palestinian struggle has really incorporated as much as possible the use of international law and human rights framework, especially since the 1990s. And it's been an integral part of it. And for all intents and purposes, much of the Palestinian struggle is precisely rooted in that. But that led to also some dissonances. If you're recognizing the Green Line as an international legal tool, what does that mean in terms of Israel as a state to be recognized by that border? If you're talking about, you know, I mean, like all these kind of human rights frameworks, and what does that mean, you know, in terms of the solution that you're asking for? You're demanding accountability along the Green Line as occupied territory since 1967, but does that also inherently allow for this division between, you know, quote unquote, Israel proper and the settlements? Now, in Palestinian political discourse, there's a much stronger understanding that the settlements can't be separated from Israel, that Zionism operates regardless of this border. But because of this kind of integration of these aspects into our advocacy, it has created a bit of tension. And I think that was something also that Unity of the Father really tried to bring into sharper clarity. And this is part of the Oslo paradigm, which is also being kind of pushed back against a little bit. It's to say that, yes, international law is important. Yes, human rights is important. But we're also seeing throughout the world that those things are mattering less and less, that the hopes that we had and even accountability for those international laws no longer exists, and that we need to assert a more political nature to our struggle, not just a legalistic one. It's not to say to abandon it, but it's to come to a clear understanding that an anti-colonial movement needs to be referred to and termed in the political sense. And if we want to be honest with ourselves and with the regime that we're operating in, we have to come back to that first point where that green line in terms of geography is not playing out. It does not exist. You have different silos within the single apartheid regime. This in no way dictates the solution. And that's a conversation of its own that Palestinians need to have. And Maron, I know many other colleagues are at the forefront of trying to come up with ideas that go beyond the conventional two-state solution. But that's a tension that really needs to be grappled with and reckoned with among Palestinian activists, scholars, thinkers, etc.
So then let's end by looking ahead a little bit more. There are clearly competing impulses over what to do about the Green Line, what to do with the Green Line. There is this push and pull between, as we've discussed, trying to unofficially erase it versus official efforts to try and pretend that it's still there and is still the basis for negotiations and so on. So what do each of you think about where we go from here? Where does the Green Line go or not go from this point on?
It's, of course, very difficult to say. I hinted somehow in what I said before, in how do I see the future, how I wish to see the future. I think that the Green Line as a border was seen by Israel, certainly after 67, after, you know, the some kind of negotiation started, and certainly since the Oslo Agreement, was seen also, not only, but also as a tool to make the results of 48 permanent, meaning the expulsion of Palestinians and not allowing them to return and tearing apart, let's say, this 78% of historical Palestine from the Palestinian. The Green Line was a tool for that, was seen as a tool for that, was conceived as a tool for that. And Israel insisted on the Green Line in order to eliminate the results, or to make them go away, forget the results of 48. This is doomed to fail. It will not happen. If this is how Israel conceived it, it is doomed to fail. And it is because Israel itself is erasing it all the time, because what we talked before, because of course the settlements, because of Bethlehem and these holy places for Judaism, and so in this sense, and also doomed to fail. But I do think that it will not, maybe not the Green Line where it stands, but the fact that these two communities that live in historical Palestine do need self-determination. And self-determination is today is still expressed by independent state. I think for this, if this is the purpose, somehow, some kind of a green line, a very diluted one, a very porous one, is still needed. But I hope we are going there.
I unfortunately don't have any kind of clear vision of also where the green line will go or what should happen with it. This is partly a recognition that even among Palestinians, we're not entirely united around exactly what that vision is. Part of it is natural. There'll always be different opinions. But you know, this kind of comes down to the questions that Imran was raising in a way whereby, you know, what does Palestinian self-determination look like today? Can Palestinians even perceive themselves living alongside Jewish Israelis, you know, those who were living under occupation or those who were refugees? Palestinian citizens of Israel, of course, you know, have grown up and lived alongside, and they have more of an advantage point to kind of build that kind of future in relation, but we're also a very small segment of the Palestinian population. So these divergences and differences are very real. And, you know, in the same way that we, for example, Inside 48, talk about the concept of equality, it's hard to talk about equality for Palestinians under occupation or refugees who, you know, have a much sharper image of Jewish Israelis as a settler society. And like, how do you ask for equality with a settler who still has taken over your land and property, etc.? I mean, the most I can say is my first point in the end is that all I've ever known in my entire life is this single state. All I've ever known is this complete absence of a green line. And again, that geography, I mean, that geographical border just doesn't exist. It's as far as a lot of Palestinians are concerned. Especially when you're a Palestinian citizen of Israel with relatively more privilege, you know, we connect with Palestinians in the West Bank and certainly less since the siege in Gaza. But even just things like the internet and telephones, it makes us constantly aware and constantly connected to our other members of the community. And so whatever future solution holds, for me, the most truthful solution is one that doesn't put these kind of artificial, arbitrary geographical borders. There's no reason why a Palestinian in Hebron can't come to Yaffa, in my eyes. And even I know like Maron has been working on the concept of like the Confederacy that gave you a loose border. But for me, just get rid of that border. Now, I think there's a lot of truth what Maron is saying, that there's still a desire for self-determination. Like Palestinians want to foresee their future that's not tied and connected or dependent upon Jewish Israelis. And I don't know exactly how that can look in the future, but there can be a way, and I would imagine there are ways to do it that doesn't have to still fall along this outdated and archaic line, which just doesn't apply to people's consciousness or their lives. Even just speaking about like the way that Palestinian economy works, you know, the unofficial economy is also that Palestinian citizens are working sometimes in the West Bank, are also, you know, having business ventures there. There's a whole entire almost like quote unquote black market that exists beyond these official things. And so there's an infrastructure for that that can exist beyond this line. The question is, can we make it equitable? Can we make it such that we're not just having privilege for Jewish Israelis, which the green line, I worry in many respects, will inevitably reinforce in some form or another. And I know these are the debates that Maron and his group are also kind of are grappling with. So no clear answers, but I think just the more we're able to reflect that the way that society and politics operates in a much more decentralized, diversified way on the ground, I think that needs to be more reflected. The concept of statehood, whether it's, you know, pursued by Jewish Israelis or even by Palestinians, I think that statehood as a solution to your self-determination is itself part of the problem. And the conventional way of thinking about statehood and this need to assert your national identity above all else. What about our urban and city identities? What about our regional identities? What about, you know, these other aspects of politics and power that are much more immediate and local to us? And how can we do that in a way that gives us the full freedom to enjoy the land and to practice our identity across the homeland? And I think these are the real questions that need to be answered in our future thinking on this.
Amjad, Maron, thank you both for being on the 972 podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Natasha. Glad we're back on the podcast.
This episode was produced by Yahav Erez and the editors at 972 Magazine. If you like this episode of our show, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a few minutes, please leave a review. It helps other listeners find us. To become a member of 972 Magazine, visit 972mag.com/members and find out how to join. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter, The Landline, via a link you'll find in the show notes. Thanks for listening.
So imagine a six-year-old child who is coming to take treatment from Gaza, or five years old child is coming to Haifa, 4 hours drive in a taxi or a van without his parents because they are not allowed, and there's no like reasonable reason of why they are forbidden to enter.
From Mohammed Hamad. He also goes by the name Hamada. Hamada is the executive director and founder of the Mariam Foundation based in Nazareth. The Mariam Foundation provides assistance to Palestinian cancer patients from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip who are being treated in Israeli hospitals. We hear from Hamada about the work of the Mariam Foundation. What Mariam Foundation works to ensure that Palestinians from the river to the sea are obtaining treatment.
My name is Mohammed Hamed from Palestine, Nazareth. And the Maryam Foundation started 10 years ago, 2012. It all started when we as a family, Palestinian family living in Nazareth, struggled when my sister Maryam got leukemia. And after 3 years of battling cancer with my sister Maryam, as we all know, all the family, it's changed all the lifestyle of the family when there's a member who have cancer or who is dealing with cancer. So she was 8, and there's twins, Maryam and Ranin, and Maryam was 8 years old. She got cancer when she was 5. I was 12 years old at that time in 2002. After 3 years of battling cancer in Rambam Hospital in Haifa, we realized the true reality of how a Palestinian cancer patient faced cancer. So it wasn't about, the Maryam Foundation wasn't about establishing the, about like problems that we face as a family, because our problems was we come from a privileged family that the treatment was available and the transportation and everything we need and daily companions, translation, everything. We don't even need translation, as we all know that we can also speak Hebrew as a Palestinian living in Nazareth. But after 3 years of battling cancer with Maryam, we faced that, we knew the reality that 80% of the Palestinian cancer community in Gaza and the West Bank are taking treatment in the occupied Palestine. So in that time, we also realized that every cancer patient from these 80% is allowed to enter the occupied Palestine and the Israeli hospitals only with one companion.
Israel has blocked many types of oncological treatment, including chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and PET and CT scanners from entering the Gaza Strip. Limits are also placed on the equipment that is allowed into hospitals in the West Bank. As a result, Palestinians with cancer are forced to seek treatment elsewhere, paying either at their own expense or with the Palestinian Authority paying on their behalf.
Imagine a six-year-old child who is coming to take treatment from Gaza, or five years old child is coming to Haifa, 4 hours drive in a taxi or a van, without his parents because they are not allowed, and there's no like reasonable reason of why they are forbidden to enter the occupied Palestine. He will come with a total stranger. How things work in Gaza, like when someone has cancer, when they discover that he has cancer, after they discover that he has cancer, they have to beg for the Palestinian Authority to give him a transformation fees to come and enter and have a treatment accepted. They will start to see, okay, if the mother is not allowed to come, or the parents, and they will start to show, okay, maybe the grandmother or the grandfather, and if all the family is forbidden, and that's like, it happens a lot, then they will start searching on the neighbors or strangers. So many times, a six-year-old child comes with a stranger, and he's frightened, he doesn't know anything, doesn't know the language. So then in that time, we as the family is taking care of my sister. We knew these people, and these people are our people. Like, it's like, I was like 12 years old. For the first time, I meet people from Gaza, and we always hear about Gaza, and I come from a family who has very, very strong Palestinian roots. So we were always like, my mother were always explaining, like, these are your people. We cannot see them because it's like there's all the politics and what's happening.
Although Maryam was from Nazareth, which is home to 3 hospitals that predate the State of Israel, Maryam was forced to obtain cancer treatment in Haifa, as none of the 3 hospitals had oncology units at the time. Why? Because for decades, Israel has failed to provide sustained support to these hospitals, forcing patients to instead go to other hospitals for treatment. As his sister was being treated, Hamada and his family often served as support systems for the other children from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. He often brought along his violin to entertain the kids. His mother sang the children to sleep with lullabies, and his family served as translators, translating from Hebrew to Arabic.
I remember my mother was every night singing for Maryam and putting Maryam like letting Maryam like to sleep, and after she is done with Maryam, she will go do this. She did the same with all the Palestinian cancer patients there, and she also was translating for them. I used to play in 2004. I used to play the violin for 12 years, so I used to take my violin and do parties for them. And there was nothing for these children. no translation, no daily companions, nothing. They only have the medicine and the treatment, and we all know the doctor will give the medicine and that's it. He's not responsible of giving any emotional support. And we all know that cancer, and it needs like 80%, to, in my opinion, 80% of to have a successful treatment is the emotional support. So in that time, I was like, we faced many problems, and we as a family took this cause like as personal, and we started doing activities for them.
Sadly, Maryam passed away in 2004. She was 8 years old at the time. Hamada, then 15, vowed that he would work to try to support Palestinians seeking cancer treatment and to raise awareness about early cancer detection. He was too young to start an organization on his own, so when he turned 21, the legal age to form an NGO, Mohammed set about establishing the Maryam Foundation. This year, the foundation turns 10, older than the number of years that his sister was alive.
So after the cancer came back for two times, my parents doesn't have any trust in the hospitals in Haifa. Then they realized that they wanna take her and to the States. Then they contacted the Mayo Clinic Hospital in Minnesota, and then they fly to Minnesota. And she died on September 10, 2004. And we didn't know, like I was here in Nazareth. She went there for only treatment for 3 weeks and she was in a very good shape. We didn't even expect she will lose her life in the States. And that was really like a nightmare for us, like to know that my sister died and I was in Nazareth and only my mother and my father and my grandmother was with her. So in that time, I discovered like how to lose someone you love and you're not with him. And that's what's happening every time for people from Gaza and Haifa.
As part of October's Breast Cancer Awareness Month, the Maryam Foundation, along with the Palestinian Museum and the Augusta Victoria Hospital, will be holding an event across Palestine on October 2nd at 6 p.m. This event will lead to the lighting up of the Palestinian Museum in pink. The museum is located just north of Ramallah in the city of Bir Zeit, with simultaneous broadcasts in Nazareth and in Gaza City. To support the work of the Maryam Foundation, please visit www.maryamf.org. That's www.maryamf.org. Thank you. Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the IMEU. Please don't forget to subscribe. I'm Deanna Butu. Thanks for listening.
So that's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
From helmets to sunscreen, we do everything we can to keep our kids safe. So how can the COVID-19 vaccine help protect them? COVID-19 vaccines can help keep children safe from severe illness and potential long-term effects of the virus. Millions of children in Canada and around the world have already been safely vaccinated. Help protect your child. Book their appointment at canada.ca/COVID-vaccine. A message from the Government of Canada.
The greatest joy is to begin. But new beginnings getting scarcer every year. I still recall back in the day. Your eyes so beautiful, I had to look away. Now we meet, go for a walk. But I know that the old you can't be far off. So how about after this stroll? You and me get rock and roll. My dearest friend, sit on my face. Sit on my face for old time's sake. For all the summers slipped away. Sit on my face for old time's sake. The dinners get more civilized. We've got more money and we're all a little tired. But she's still there behind your eyes. Back when each night revealed a prize. We may have families and kids, but we're still